Hey, what's going on? It's Bill Burr, and it is time for a special edition of the Monday Morning Podcast. You know, every once in a while, old Freckles here goes out and gets himself a guest, and today is no different, which is why we have a special podcast for this weekend. I can't think of, this is probably the biggest, it's got to be the biggest guest I've had, an absolute legend, and usually when people say this shit, they can't, you know, people, you can't follow it, but believe it or not, I have, from Aerosmith, legendary lead guitarist Joe Perry on the Monday Morning Podcast. How are you, buddy?
I'm really good, thanks. I don't know about the biggest part. I mean, most people say you look bigger. You look smaller in person, but
don't you hate that?
That don't matter. I mean, you know, it's all about the camera angle and all that stuff. But thanks, I appreciate that intro. And
do you get that a lot?
Great to be here today.
Oh, sorry. Do you get that a lot? People say that to me. Like I don't know why they think I was tall. I'm average height. I'm just under 5'10". And then they always come walking up. They're like, oh, I thought you'd be a lot bigger. It's just...
It's the way that the camera... Because usually a camera, again, technically, I mean, the camera's kind of down at eye level because they want to get you straight on.
Right.
And... Or sometimes they'll shoot you from a little below, so it's really hard to tell. To get any kind of perspective, you know what I mean?
Right.
Unless you know how tall the person is you're standing next to, that kind of thing.
Well, I get it with you. It's like you're playing like, you know, the L.A. Coliseum and you're on like a 40-foot stage. I mean, I'm standing in some chuckle hut. It's just like I'm maybe 6 inches taller than I am when I'm not on stage. So I don't know. It's always like sometimes I just think people just say shit to say shit. Like, how do you deal with like – You know what, like, amazes me about – before we get going here, the reason why Joe Perry's here, he's got a new unbelievable book, Joe Perry, My Life in and Out of Aerosmith, that's available now. And if I'm not mistaken, it already went number one, correct?
Well, I think it was number – it was on the – it's in the top 10 – was in the top 10 New York Times bestseller list. It was in the top 10 for 2 weeks. And
this is why your career has lasted for so long, because you're this honest. Most people would have just been like, yeah, man.
Yeah,
it's,
well,
number one all over the place.
Yeah, but it's like anybody that sees it. But the thing is, all they say is top seller, and they print that on the top, and that's kind of like the stamp that says that at least more than one person has read it. And and the other thing is I'm not here just because of the book. I'm here because you're a bud from way back, and I've been looking forward to doing a podcast with you anyway.
Oh, that's awesome,
man. For a while. So it's it gives me a chance to yak about the book, but I also get a chance to have some laughs for a change. You know?
Good deal. And I promise I'm going to try to steer away from the usual – You know, so what's Steven like? How do you pick out your leather pants or whatever? Although I might ask you that one because
ask me anything you want, and I guarantee the answers will be totally different than they've been from before, because a lot of it's not so much the questions, it's how they're asked and who's asking them.
Oh, okay, all right, I like that. Well, here's one for you. Is what blows my mind nowadays with the whole Twitter thing and Facebook and the whole interactive thing was back in the day. There was no way for me to ever write you something that you would ever, I guess, fan mail or something like that. Just the level of like interaction that people can have. In fact, like when I bought your first albums, it was like, maybe 80, 81 or something like that. So this was just before MTV.
Right.
I didn't even know who was who. Cause I'd turn over the album.
Sure.
Well, I guess I got Greatest Hits first and they didn't have a picture of you guys. But, when I got like Toys in the Attic or something, I remember I turned it over and I was trying to figure out which one's Steve, which one's Joe, you know, who's Tommy and all
right.
That type of stuff. How have you felt like having lived the old way, like pre-MTV, where people didn't, you know, hardcore fans, they had no idea what you looked like. So you could be a little more anonymous if you walk down the street, to like this whole thing now where people can be like, nice book, asshole. Why'd you pick this picture? You know, you're sitting there eating toast in your fucking kitchen. Doesn't it annoy the shit? I hate the fucking heckles when I'm at home.
Well, it's interesting because you got to keep in mind that it's a very small percentage of the people that are out there. So you know, a lot of times you can get like sucked into the whole Twitter thing or Facebook or all that stuff, all the different outlets that there right. are, and you can go, God, I can't believe that people think that, or how could they say that? And it's like, you got to remember that it's like maybe 1% that are actually, like, you know, looking at it. But
well, how long
in
did
the
it
great
take
scheme
you?
Of things, you know? But it's kind of like it's a good thing and a bad thing. It gives people a voice, and it's kind of like the, like we've said before, it's like the town square, and you're hanging out in the town square, and anybody can say what they want. Some people want to stand on a soapbox so they can be heard, and very often they get carried away in a white jacket. But
how long did it take for you to get to this Zen place? Because it's something that I kind of bad. Like, most times I'm like, all right, whatever. Hey, you know, whatever. The last eight were good. What, are they all going to be good? But, like, just every once in a while, somebody just writes something so mean that I get, like, an urge to, like, I just wish there was an app where you could find out where they lived.
Yeah.
And just drive over and, you know, it's funny. I drive over and then lose a fight to them. But, you know, in my fantasy, I win.
Yeah, well, sometimes you have to do that to let off some steam. But, not actually do it, but just kind of go through the mental process. But the point is that you read some of that stuff, and it can be so mean-spirited because they know that they're anonymous, and it's like kind of a drag. But I don't know. Lately, it's been pretty
positive.
Pretty okay, you know,
oh, that's
it's
cool.
been kind of even, and you know, you just kind of pay attention to the different ones. I mean, some people will only listen to like one particular thing, or they'll kind of you know, drop into at different phases and things like that. So I don't know. It's just another outlet, but sometimes we do use it for input when we're talking about a set list, you know, we're
right.
on the road, we're thinking about, you know, what should we put in there? And sometimes somebody will tweet a song, and we'll go, I think we remember how to play that one. We'll throw it in the set.
Can I put out a request?
Of course.
One that I've always wanted to see play live. It's off your first album, Moving Out.
Well, let me write that down, because that's one song that we do play once in a while.
Do you play that live?
We played it, I think, the second to last show of the tour. And we went right into Walking the Dog right
after. Oh, you did?
So it was kind of like, you know.
I think your first album is so underrated because that, if I remember correctly, you basically, you guys, even after you sold that album, you hadn't gone national yet. And it was kind of like, you kind of got like New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, Massachusetts, sort of New England, and maybe just into Connecticut and New York.
Yeah, exactly. And it was really like, it was an uphill fight, Ma. You know, I mean, it was, you know, people think, you know, and if looking from the outside, you know, and they're looking at the trade magazines, and then all of a sudden there's a band on the charts, and it seems like they're overnight. But, you know, you forget. I mean, and it goes. It's been the same ever since the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles spent years and years in those clubs in Hamburg, sleeping in the bathroom, working hard, I mean, busting their ass. And the same thing with us. I mean, we worked the clubs and kind of spread out, and we'd go through Ohio and play, you know, all the towns in Ohio,
right?
And then making our way to Detroit. And Detroit, of course, their favorite band was Jay Giles, so they were willing to give another band from Boston a listen and give us a second chance, you know. And when we went out there, they really took us to heart. And then coming back to Boston, the first album had come and kind of gone, but the record company gave us another chance, and we did the second record, and then they re-released Dream On. And it started to get played on the radio. That was back when DJs could actually play what they wanted.
I know, right?
You know?
It's
I mean,
crazy
could,
now.
You know, you could actually go up there and talk to them, play them something, and if it was any good, they would play it. You know, it was pretty cool.
That's amazing. You know what? I was just back east doing Dennis and Cam's Comics Come Home.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, it was the 20th anniversary of that show. And I remember one of the times I did it, you came out and played with the band, which was
right.
awesome. And I'll tell you one thing that strikes me is every time I go back to Boston, because I moved away in 95, it becomes less and less like what I left, and I'm going to be, oh, I'm going to get a greasy slice of pizza here, and then it's gone. Right. And I'm finding it, all these areas that used to be scary are getting like nicer and nicer. And I remember what always kills me was when they talk about when you guys were struggling, they're like, yeah, we were all struggling. We were all living in this beat up apartment on Commonwealth Avenue, which is like Park Avenue now, in downtown Boston. And I was wondering, do you miss, like, when you go through Boston, I don't know how often you get to go back there. Do you like the direction it went with the whole Big Dig and turning Southie into like a bunch of condos and crap?
Certainly the Big Dig was an event in everyone's life who lives in Boston. But I mean, there's no doubt. And you know,
why did they just make one fucking lane? They turned everything. It was a complete waste of time. Oh, and other than aesthetically, I'm fucking, you know, I was driving to the airport. As I went to the airport, you know, I tried to take the Ted Williams Tunnel. So yeah. I get off. I have a 7 a.m. flight. It's like 4:45 in the morning. And so I get off the Ted Williams exit, and then I get to the fork in the road. We make a left to do it, and there's all these fucking cones set up. So then I have to go by that and the Catalan Tunnel, flipping the fuck out, cursing Boston up and down for the fucking state worker meathead. And I don't even think that they did it by accident. I literally think that they do it on purpose. And then you fucking go through all of the bullshit. And once again, it's one lane to get to the airport. So it was like, what was the purpose of all of that?
You know, it's like, go figure. I mean, there's it's all about progress under the name of progress. I mean, that's what this whole country's built on, and growth and all that. And I mean, I think that things have to change there. I don't want to get into that right now. But the bottom line is,
are you going to run for office?
I haven't been home that much. I've been out here, you know, from the time we were working on the last Aerosmith record, and then going on the road, and then coming back and finishing the record, and then going on the road again, and then working on the book all through that. I've been spending all my time here, and.
I know you sound like you caught a cold a little bit.
And the allergies here, it's like, it's really wet, you know, in the back here. It's beautiful. I mean, he's got like fountains everywhere, and it's just beautiful, but the allergies get you. And I was just reading an article in one of the Huffington Post, or one of those things, and they were saying how that people's allergies, or not allergies, but their whole nasal thing was like starting to like react to a lot of the differences, because they travel so much, and there are so many different things that affect people. And
right.
So if you're wondering why your nose is different, that's why, because your nose is working overtime. It's got nothing to do with anything from
being
south of the border,
anything?
You know, or anything like that. It's just strictly your body reacting to the different stuff in the air, whether it's pollen. I mean, I know in Massachusetts, there's that time of the year where all the pine pollen comes down and it covers your car green and all that.
Yeah, you get sick then too? Or get like,
it's
congested? It's got to drive you nuts.
It's terrible. It's like...
How do you handle that if you have like a show, if you're doing a Joe Perry thing, Joe Perry project, where you have to sing?
Well, I have to use a little bit of that spray, you know, that you get at the drugstore, and it works as long as you don't use too much of it, you know, but it works, and it's, then you get through it.
That shit never works for me. Somebody gave me that the other day. I'm doing a cartoon. We got to get you on, like we have music and stuff in between your projects.
Really?
Yeah, we're kind of doing this thing. It takes place in like the 70s. I can't give too much of it away. It's not coming out for like another year, but you know, we're doing some stuff, period stuff from the 70s. Like, you remember when Plant and Page used to do that call and response thing on the guitar?
Oh, yeah.
He'd be like,
"Oh yeah, yeah, yeah."
Wah, wah. So we kind of got some people listening to music like that. And I as I was driving over here today, I was like, "Jesus Christ!" You know, I mean. I should have got you in on the fucking thing. We're having somebody try to put together like a song for us or whatever. But I'd love to have you come in, maybe even do a voice or something like that at some point.
Well, that's one of the good things about all this technology is you don't have to be in the same room at the same time. You know, I mean, certainly there's a advantage to that. But, you know, if you can't be there physically, you can certainly, you know, send the files and you can work on it and talk on the phone. I mean, I just did a... an overdub on one of Johnny Winter's songs, God Rest His Soul. You know, he called me up and said, do you want to play on the record? And I said, yeah, great. And they sent me the files, and I played on it. And
like right from your house? Record.
Yeah. Well,
Jesus.
Here, there's a studio right next door, so we went in and cut some
Well, as you noticed, I'm not too good with technology. I got to tell my listeners the embarrassing beginning to my podcast. I was in a rush to get over here. I'm freaking out. Joe Perry from Aerosmith, and I show up. I got two microphones. I got everything, but I only have one mic cord. And rock star Joe Perry goes, I'll go next door and get one. Like, he's getting old. Like, he has all cool neighbors. So, like, he's like, I'd go over and get a cup of sugar. He goes over and gets a microphone cord.
Well, it would stand to reason I'd hang around with kind of musical people. But also, we stay at the hotel, you know, the Sunset Marquee. I don't know where you're staying, but they have a studio downstairs. And that's the only hotel I know of in the world where you can call room service and get a microphone at 2 in the morning.
Is that right?
I mean, if you're like, I've done a lot of writing. In fact, there's a picture of me in the room working on one of the songs for the record. And, and we just set up with the computer and some outboard gear and some microphones, and I'll be sitting there, and I actually wrote the song there, and some of the tracks actually made it on the record. But you know, we're just sitting in the living room, you know, and it's and I needed a mic cord, and I called down, and they had it there, and it was.
Do you find that new technology makes you more creative, or is it like, you know, sometimes there's people out here where even if they like write, they're sitting there going like, well, I got to at least have an office where I go to sit down and write, because if I don't, I'm sitting here, the TV's here, the kitchen's here, I'm not going to create. Do you find the new technology where wherever you go, there's a studio, makes you procrastinate more, or do you work more?
It's definitely a lot more, it takes a lot more get up and go to do it, because there are so many more distractions. There's no doubt about it. Everything from, you know, 1,000 channels on TV to whatever you're into. I mean, football 24 hours a day. I mean, whatever. There's so many things that, you know, it's an advantage because you can choose. But on the other hand, it's like to be able to record in your own house can be like the worst thing and the best thing. I mean, you can always say, well, I can put it off till tomorrow.
Right.
Because you don't, you know, you haven't booked time in a studio where they're going to charge you $1,500 a day, whereas you've already put a deposit down on a studio. And
right.
So you have to go. So there's kind of like, there's that end of it. And then there's also, but it really has to come from inside, and you have to really want to do it. And I mean, you know, you're a creative guy. You see things, obviously,
Joe, I wouldn't go that far.
In a different way than most of us.
I wouldn't go that far.
And you see the humor and stuff, and, you know, stuff that we would never occur to the rest of us. But that's why you make us laugh. And the thing is, that's an art. And it's
hey, let me ask you this. You said that Sunset Marquee is the only hotel that you know that you can order a microphone. What's the craziest thing you ever ordered room service? You're on the road. You're in the middle of nowhere.
It wasn't so much the craziest thing. It was the quantity.
Oh, yeah? Were you talking grams here? what did you order?
Well, enough for, say, 30 people.
what is...
Dom Perignon, by the case. I can remember staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel in the 70s, and it was kind of like the Party Central, because they have bungalows out back, you know, like...
Jeez, and it's the 70s, and everything can be cured as far as STDs go and all that. I mean, do you ever miss it? Like, I look at some of the 70s, right?
Yeah.
And I just really wish... I mean, of course, it's all been romanticized in books and movies and all that shit, but do you... Like, aside, everybody likes being younger. Do you miss those days, like, thinking about, like, just how a lot freer and crazier you could be without worrying about somebody with a cell phone camera? I'm talking about single Joe Perry. I got this drinking and drugging thing under control. Like, you're just having a good time. You're playing with your band. You're selling records and all that. Is there a part of you that you ever just – you ever, like, when you're driving down Sunset and just looking at spots going, like, dude, I fucking – bought a kilo of Coke there and had one of the best hot dogs I ever had in my life, hanging with John Bonham or something. Do memories like that still come?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, especially here in L.A., and there are a couple of places that are still, you know, the same buildings. Some of them changed the names, but, I mean, there's the Whiskey A Go-Go, and there's Book Soup, which has been there forever, which is right. One of the greatest bookstores going next to City Lights up in Frisco, and then there's one in Paris that's really good. But you know, there are these certain places that are still there, and, you know, the Rainbow and the Roxy. And
who are some of the people you remember seeing in the Rainbow? Just because fans are like me, who are like nerds, it's like Rainbow, you just want to go to the same place that they stood in.
Chances are, if they were playing in town, you could almost guarantee to see whoever was playing. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the time, you know, a lot of people would just, if they were in the middle of a tour, they had a couple days off, they would definitely come to L.A. to hang out, because right. There's such a great scene here for, you know, back then. And you could literally, like, run into anybody there.
What's craziest thing you ever saw go down at, like, the Rainbow Room or the Whiskey or whatever? Like, the most...
Well, I only hung out there a few times because I...
You don't have to name any names. I'm not trying to get you in trouble with anybody.
But I just... it was just a couple of times I've been there, you know. I mean, actually probably a lot more than I remember, but it's probably a lot more than I would forget, actually.
Maybe you're the central person in the story. You just don't remember the story. One time I saw Joe Perry.
But, you know, it was basically a kind of a meeting place for everybody. They would come down from the hills, you know, run into whoever, and then the tables would empty out and as people would take off. Mm-hmm. And it was that kind of a place. But and I haven't been up there, you know, since Jesus in forever. So
well, I can guarantee you, I don't think they've changed anything. When you walk in there, all of the covers on the seat and everything just look like they've been there since the beginning of time.
I would bet. And the Whiskey is pretty much the same. As I remember when we played there, our first time here in L.A., and then we played there, you know, not too long ago, and it was pretty much the same.
Oh, that's cool.
It was a great vibe, you know. It's kind of like the Paradise. I don't even know. Have they changed the Paradise at all?
In Boston?
Yeah.
Dude, the Paradise has been gone for, I think, almost 20 years.
Well, I guess they've changed it then.
It's probably like
a... Is it a club still, or is it a...
No, you know the deal. It's probably one of those fucking Panera Bread...
Yeah.
Things, and you're just thinking, yeah, you too, and the Police started here, some of their first gigs, I guess, in the United States were here. You know, I just realized as I'm sitting in here, can't imagine the amount of times you've sat in a room where there was just a suit of armor over in the corner.
Yeah.
Like some Scooby-Doo shit. This seems like some real, like, rock star stuff, like you just got to have a suit of armor near you, right? That helps your creative process.
It came with the place.
Oh, it did?
You know, but oddly enough, I did have one in my house in the 70s. I had a suit of armor at the door. And
Where do you buy that?
Well,
don't you have to buy a castle?
Once in a while, it's not a real one, obviously. I mean, it's not like a one that I mean, you can tell it's like a mock-up of one, but it still looks really cool. And
how do you know it's not real? Because there's no marks on it.
If you look at this, where the screws hold it together, they kind of like didn't cut off the ends. So if you were to put it on, you'd kind of look like. You just got attacked by about 100 mosquitoes or wasps or whatever, because all those nails would be sticking in you. If you took the helmet off, you'd see like the rivets sticking out. So it's really not made to wear.
I just looked at it, and I didn't see any scuff marks on it. I just figured that was like the king's son, who never had to go to battle, but he'd parade down the street in the fucking thing.
Well, that's a good observation, because it's probably true. But, I mean, it's probably copied off of... Off of a real one, but there are places you can get things like that. You see an odd one odd piece in the corner, or some home and garden place or whatever, and you know, I guess that's where they come from, you know.
But hey, I saw you guys at Jones Beach in like 2006. Awesome show as always, and. Motley Crue was opening for you guys on that tour, and they're recently. I think this is going to be their final tour. and all that. Do you remember the, because I'm a huge, you know, being a drummer geek, I'm a huge fan of Tommy Lee. He was just like, you know, just the show that that guy puts on while also playing a beat is just amazing. I've always loved him. And I was wondering, do you remember the first time you guys, did you tour with them during their, when they were just young guys coming up?
Actually, I saw them at one of their first gigs at the Santa Monica Civic Center when I was with the project. I was out here doing some gigs. And
just for the fans, was this the first time Stephen left during that period? Was this like early? Because
no, this was when I left in 1979, and I was out here with the project at some point. I'm not exactly sure when, but the bottom line is I got to see them play, you know, at the Santa Monica Civic Center, which is, I don't know, 3,000 to 5,000 seats, and the buzz was out on them, so the place was pretty packed. And
is that what got you there? You just heard a good buzz about them. You're like, I'm going to go check these guys out.
Yeah, and they said, well, somebody said this is the new hot band on the strip, and you should check them out. And so I went down, and I'm not sure if I met them then, but there were. We had a couple of friends in common, and I remember meeting Nikki Sixx and just kind of like, you know, being kind of friends with them, you know, from right. just kind of watching their career. And then we were in Vancouver doing, I think it was the second record, not Permanent Vacation, but I think it was the next one, Pump, I think, and there are two studios in that place, Little Mountain, up there in Vancouver, and they were in the other studio. And so we ran into each other a lot.
Oh, wow. So they were probably doing Dr. Feelgood right around then. That was 89, 90,
actually,
right?
That's right. They were Mr. Rock, the producer, was producing their record, I think. And
Bobby Rock, right?
That's it. And he was, and they sounded great, and it was, you know, we ran into them pretty much daily, and they, and of course some of the guys, you know, would tag after the session, they would tag along and go down to the clubs, you know, Vancouver reputably probably has the best. From what I've heard, has some of the best strip clubs in the world.
You gave them a ride, right? You're like, yeah, I'm the headliner. I'll give you youngsters a ride down there.
They knew everybody by the first name by the time they left, I have to say.
Was that hard to be around guys like that? Because I know by then you'd long since cleaned up and everything. You had your fun, basically, at that point?
Not at all. I mean, it was not an issue. I mean, they would party like late at night after they were done. But when they came into the studio in the afternoon, they were all business, just like, you know.
That's what I figure. Is that a myth as far as people like?
It's not like they walked in with a bottle of Jack Daniels and said, let's go. It's like, you know, they had work to do. It shows because that was a great record. You know?
Hey, did you ever call anybody out for doing the iced tea in the Jack Daniels bottle? You know, I've heard of a couple bands, they would put iced tea in the Jack Daniels bottle, and then they'd go out in front of the crowd and act like they were crazy, and they'd just be chugging iced tea.
I heard about that, but I've never...
You never busted anybody doing that?
I never ran into anybody that did it, but I heard stories about bands doing that. But, you know, of course, they don't rate very high on my respect list, but, you know...
That'd be like a prop act with the comedian.
If you're going to drink it, you might as well drink it. You know what I mean? And what's the problem if you don't? So,
well, I don't care how the big giveaway is. I don't care how much you drink. Nobody can chug hard alcohol. You just can't do it. You can fit. Like I've seen guys take big gulps, but once you start throwing the thing back, like Joe Green in that famous commercial when he's drinking Coca-Cola, and even he had a couple times and a couple takes, he had to stop and belch or whatever. There's no way you could do it with hard alcohol. But before we go any further, I wanted to ask you, you got a really cool tattoo on your forearm there of it's like an old school gun. What's the story behind that?
Smith & Wesson break top Schofield. I guess it was designed back in the 1800s.
Oh, yeah?
And it's I just like the shape of it. It's one of my favorite designs. It's an old revolver. And
you know, there's a place in New Orleans. I had an acting gig down there, and somewhere in the French Quarter, they had all these old guns and rifles. You ever been in there?
I've dropped way too much money in that place.
Yeah, I wanted to buy my dad this. It was a rifle from like the 1812. Right, it was insane, and they even had the bayonet and everything. And my dad likes that type of shit. But the thing was, for me to get it from Louisiana all the way up, like, first of all, I couldn't get it shipped because Massachusetts has some sort of laws.
Right.
So then I'd have to would have had to buy it and then drive it up there. And as I was crossing state borders, I just kept thinking about Tommy Chong when he sent the bongs out and shit. Right. And all of a sudden he had the feds at his door. And, you know, who the fuck's going to drive from New Orleans all the way up to Massachusetts and drive 55? It's not going to be me. I'm going to drive 80 at some point and be like, I'm fine.
It's tough. I think that
big musket hanging out the back.
You know, again, without getting into the politics of things, I mean, I just think that things should be a little more standardized as far as firearms go. I think they should be. I mean, people should be given at least, you know, put through more schooling before they're given a permit, and it should be more standardized from state to state, because there are some states where it's easier to get firearms and there are other states where it's really hard, and it's hard to keep track of it, you know?
Yeah, and it's insane how in some states you can basically just go in and buy it and not have to prove any sort of capability. I mean, it'd be like giving, like, somebody doesn't know how to drive keys to a car. It's like they're going to kill somebody. But I honestly don't have a problem with guns. I think they're cool as long as the right person owns it, which is the big, of course, fly in the ointment. But what are some of your you liked the gun you just mentioned there? What are some of your go-to guns, like, right now? Some of the modern stuff. What do you like?
Well, I'm not really a. I mean, I have a few modern firearms. I collect all kinds of weapons. I've even got an old Greek sword. It's made out of bronze. It's all like it's green and it's actually quite small.
So if somebody broke into your house.
Those guys were very small, you know. I mean, people were smaller than, you know.
Right.
And so this, everything is like seems a little smaller. But anyway,
if somebody broke into your house, you can't tell me if they're coming up the stairs, right? And the only weapon you see is that old Greek sword. Part of you's got to be like, God, that cost me a fortune.
Well,
do I really want to run this guy through with it?
What they're going to be doing is focusing on that while I walk up behind them with my shotgun.
Oh, you're a shotgun inside guy, huh?
Well, I do have, you know, I mean, they're reliable. They're and.
But what about
I understand there's a. You, if you're in that situation, there's a level of panic that comes with it, and I've never been in that situation, fortunately. And I hope it stays that way. But you know, I've never been in the Army. I've never been trained, and you know, so I kind of look at things like the easiest thing that would be to have, you know, around for if somebody got that far. You know, would be something that would be very easy to use, and a shotgun comes into that heading. So, but again, it's like
it's an efficiency thing. I've always, you know, because I've actually, you know, toured through the South, and I always tell them they're out of their minds to have a shotgun in their house. I got a whole bit coming out on my next special about it, where I always think all you need is like a 22, because it's easy. My big thing is when you're in the dark, if you shoot, you can still hear. It doesn't – you've already lost your sight. It's not going to take away your hearing too. And people always laugh at a 22, but it's like, dude, if I had a loaded 22 and I pointed it at you, you're diving. You're running away. And if I started shooting you with it, you wouldn't be laughing going, this is a 22. I could shoot you with a BB gun. You'd be like, I'm going to get the fuck out of here.
People, you know – and also it's kind of hard to tell, you know, what it is you have in your hand. The whole thing is it's so much – there's so much psychology that goes along with it. And I've studied a lot of that because
Again, you know, if you're going to have, it's a great responsibility to own firearms. And I've done a lot of study. I've worked with people. I haven't actually gone to any of the places where you can go to train, but I've talked to a lot of the instructors and so on. And from what I gather, handguns are probably the least effective, even in the hands of trained.
You miss.
Trained people.
So it is.
People miss. I think that Hemingway said that of all the weapons out there, the weapon that misses the most is a handgun, because there's so much moving and so much going on, and it's.
But I would think just the sound alone. I'm hearing a gun. I'm not going to be sitting there, if I'm breaking your house, counting shots like they do in the movie, and then I'll be at the bottom going, Joe. I know you're out of bullets.
Yeah.
Come out with your hand. I mean, I'm not going to fight. The second somebody starts shooting at me, I'm thinking, I'm going to go rob another house. I would just think people would do that, but well, I don't know. You know what? I did see you on that show. Was it Son of a Gun?
Yeah, Sons of Guns. Yeah.
Sons of Guns, man. Yeah. That must have been fun as hell. For people who don't know, I don't even know if it's still on. There's so many friggin' channels and shows, but these guys just, it was like a hot rod show, except it was guns. And these guys would just make these insane weapons, and then people got to come on the show. You know, they'd weld like M60s to like the top of a Prius or something like that, right?
Right.
What did you get to shoot on that? Like some anti-aircraft gun?
They had a couple of hot-rodded, so to speak, you know, like M16s and things like that. So we shot those. But the main thing was I had this old cannon that was actually from the 1800s, and I really didn't know much about it, and they kind of cleaned it up a little bit and got into the serial number, and it was actually a military issue, and it was actually a naval gun, and when two ships are at sea and they want to transport like a cargo or a person or something back and forth, they need to send a line from one ship to the other, so they use this cannon, which is, it's only about 3 feet long, and they shoot this lead dart over to the other boat, and it takes a rope with it. Then they attach a bigger rope to it, then a bigger rope and a bigger rope, and then finally they have this pulley thing so they can transport stuff back and forth. So that's what it was for.
How many people you think accidentally got killed on the other ship? You know, when they, I mean, even though that they knew that they were shooting it over, it was just such not an exact science. You didn't really take wind. You know, you kind of wet your finger back then, right?
I have a feeling that people would probably keep their heads up watching where the thing was going. I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah, but you go to a baseball game, somebody gets dinged in the head all the time. They're just fucking sitting there. Yeah. And these guys are like trying to hit 100 mile an hour pitches. And there's always somebody just sitting there eating and talking. And they always get hit in the chest, thank God. Like a few people have actually gotten hit in the head. But yeah. I got to ask you this something about cannons that I realized as I was talking to you. My only knowledge of cannons is what I've seen in cartoons. I'm not even trying to be funny here. And they try to make it look like, you know, the thing that they stick in there is like a little bomb, and then they shoot it and it explodes. But it's really just a giant, like, ball made out of metal, and that gets launched through gunpowder, right? So there's this giant metal ball that pokes a hole in your ship and sinks it?
Well, some of them are – from what I understand, because I've read quite a few historic novels, and that part of history fascinates me. You know, the tall ships and all that, and apparently some of the things they would put in there would actually be filled with gunpowder with a fuse. Okay. So when it would get shot off, it would, you know, it was very inaccurate, and you know, once in a while it would work. But it would land on the ship and hopefully explode, but whatever.
Well, that goes back to the dart. I'm saying it's very inaccurate. They'd shoot it, and they'd probably, somebody caught it in the leg, right? And then they got to saw it off. They just give them some whiskey, right?
I'll tell you, medicine was not anything near what we think of medicine, up to the end of the night of the 18th century. It was like just basically that, you know, if you got a hangnail, foot is coming off, or you know, it was
really
bad.
And then they would do that thing to stitch you up. They just stick your leg in a fire.
Yeah, I mean, quick, easy, cheap. You know,
so, isn't it amazing? Like the amount of pain that you can actually take. Do you know? I saw this thing. as far as like horrific ways, horrific ways to die. They had this thing, okay, you did something, they decided that you were going to die. And they had this giant, like, it was like a fucking brass cow or some sort of animal made out of some sort of metal, right?
Right.
And they would stick you in the fucking thing. How they ever got you in, because I would have just killed myself. They stick you in the fucking thing, they close it up, and then they light a fire underneath it, and they would just basically cook you. I've always thought about that, laying in there as it's getting hot, bouncing all around like someone who fucking fell off a motorcycle trying not to have the heat on you for too long.
Right.
It's just the fucking agony. And how these people could just sit there and who's that guy who used to they'd put you on a what the fuck do they call it? The impaler.
Oh yeah, Vlad. The Dracula they called him.
I love how you said that like you knew him. Oh yeah, Vlad.
Well, I mean I've read that stuff, you know. I mean, we've all read it. We've seen it in movies and you know, he's
I actually watched
Vlad the Impaler
videos.
And there he, you know, what amazes me is the way that people have invented to fuck other people up over the years. It just blows my mind.
What's the worst one you ever heard?
Oh God! Well, that was pretty close. I mean, that really like that, and I can't imagine being. I mean, I love horses, but I can't imagine being tied to four of them.
Ugh.
You know what I mean? And then having somebody yell, "Go, okay, pull a little harder." Not even like, you know, get up and go, and like making it short, but like actually just kind of like.
Oh, they
slowly
wouldn't. They slowly
apart.
Had him walk apart.
You know
apart?
What I mean? That kind of thing. That sounds like a pretty rotten way to go.
For those people listening at home who don't, you basically they would tie, you know, your wrist to one horse, you know, your wrist to another, your ankle to one, and they would walk in four different directions, and then they'd slowly fucking dislocate your joints, and then eventually just pull you apart.
And that's
I would
but
just
one
be
thing
screaming.
One thing I do want to say, going back to something we were talking about before, which was about, you know, home and home defense and all that. But one of the things that I've learned from talking to umpteen people about this, and that is that a dog, any size dog, is probably the most effective thing you could have in your house for safety. Just because the main thing is getting enough time to either deal with what you have to deal with, make the 911 call, you know, jump out the window if that's what has to happen, pull out whatever your last ditch weapon of choice is. But the main thing is buying some time, and a dog will basically send the guy off to somebody else's house, and then it's their problem.
I got a dog. My dog will do that like every once in a while. I'll be sleeping, and I get so terrified. I'll just be sleeping. All of a sudden, dog just starts going.
Yeah. Oh, you know.
And I sit there going like, what? And I sit up in bed. I'm such a coward. And I'm immediately like, and then I'm thinking like, I should have got a gun. I should have bought a gun. You know, I wish I had a bat here or something.
Well,
I got
bat's a good thing. Too,
yeah, I have a knife. Know? This cop told me a knife is stupid because you got to get in close. So at least have a bat.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is all. This
but
is
the
all
dog, and again, a dog, a small dog, any dog that's, you know, becomes part of the family, he's going to protect the pack, and he's going to let somebody know. And that really, they on all the lists I've ever seen, they're like in the top three things you could have that could be the best thing.
That's
and,
awesome.
Anyway, I just wanted to mention
I gotta
that.
Ask, so we've got to wind down here because I gotta. Another frinkin' thing I got to run to. Once again, sorry that I didn't have a extra mic cord.
No, that's okay.
That was
hey,
pretty unprofessional,
on.
Man.
Hey.
I didn't even mention
kidding?
You went over there twice because the other thing, the first one you brought didn't fit my stupid mixer.
It actually goes to an old microphone that like an old style one that needs power. So it had two more extra prongs and it didn't work.
You're
so
being too kind. The
no
reality
problem.
Is I showed up unprepared. But I got. Let me ask you. Can I ask you some? Music geek questions here.
Sure.
Okay.
Whatever you want, man.
All right. The best live band, other than your own band, best live band you ever saw.
Well, I have to say, my theory is that a rock and roll show. If we're talking about rock and roll,
is
the interaction between the fans and the band, and
a lot of times you might be in a club, and it might not even be a big band, but they've got good songs, and they're getting the audience off, and the audience is giving them love, and the band is giving it back, and you get that feeling like, wow, this is magic. And right then, they might be the best band.
Right.
You know, that night, they're the best band, and, you know, you walk away and you feel great, and it was like an incredible show. So that's kind of like what we strive for as a band.
Try
and get that magic going, and that's the thing you can't – I mean, you can line everything up, make sure the guitars are in tune, make sure everything's working, but it's really about – you know, hooking up with the audience and having that interaction and having that excitement. And I have to say that one of the shows that I've seen recently was actually the Stones. I mean, and it sounds like, you know, yeah, of course, pick the Stones. But I've seen them on nights when they just weren't that good. You know, I've seen them when they were really good back in the 60s. And but this particular night, we were on the road in Germany, and they played a place in Berlin, and they sounded incredible. And it was like, it was one of those nights where everything just locked together, and you could see, you know, 50 years of experience. You could hear everything. It was a perfect venue. It only held about 5,000 people, and I was blown away. I mean,
Awesome.
I figured it would be like, you know, well, it would be like, wow, they're really good for 70. No, they were as good as any band I'd ever seen, and they were as good as any of the great shows I saw in the day, and they knocked me out, man.
That's
I have to say, you know,
any young players out there? It's crazy now trying to figure out who the guys are because there's no centralized area for music anymore. But are there any young players out there that you watch them play and they inspire you? Like, man, I got to go home and practice, or I want to try to take my, you know, like just as a comedian to try to relate it. Like, you know, I love new comics, and I love seeing somebody. There's nothing I love more than seeing a young comic that I know is going to be great.
Right.
And you're seeing they got the hunger, they got the drive, they got the talent, and you know that they're going to, you know they're going to do it. That always gives me like a jolt of energy, because I remember what that was like being their age and stuff, and like how, it, you know, just sort of trying to recapture, like, you know, because sometimes you can get into the grind of it. I was wondering if there was any like bands that are out right now that make you like, fuck, man, I you know, maybe you're not near your guitar. And you're just like, fuck, I wish I had my guitar in my hand right now. I want to just start making music.
I don't know. I hear some good music. I was in the studio the other day, and there was a band that was being recording. And, you know, and the vocal wasn't on it yet, but the music sounded like it had like some real potential. It's a really hard question because it's like there are a lot of technically great players, and there's a few – like really great players that are really young. There's so much on the internet. Back when I was growing up, I had to struggle to find somebody who even played guitar, much less, get a lesson, you know.
I fucked up my foot trying to figure out John Bonham's bass drum technique, because I was trying to do it with my, like, my big toe, and I was like arching my foot, and I got like, what do you call it? That plantar fasciitis.
Really?
And now it's like you can go, because all I had was like a record player and speakers, and you're sticking your slow it down, and now like, now you just go on YouTube and somebody just shows you.
Yeah,
it's like a slide step. You just kind of move your whole foot, and it's like, you know, your leg goes up once, but you get two hits, and it's just. And then I'm watching like some fucking kid,
right,
like 8 years old, playing all that stuff, and I'm just like, they can get like a year's worth of drum lessons or guitar lessons in one night on YouTube. It's incredible.
That's exactly it, and you know, I mean, that it's all spelled out, and that's why I think there are a lot of good guitar players out there that are technically good. They can play all the stuff. But still, it still comes down to writing a good song, writing something that you know is a little bit original, and you know, and is entertaining. And it still comes down to that. You can be a wizard on guitar, But unless you're a guitar freak, you know, as far as like, you know, entertaining your average rock fan, you still got to write a good song.
You got to connect with
you know them. What I mean? And
yeah.
It's and no matter, you know, whether it's like, you know, you got 6,000 computers and you got, you know, it's running through tape machines and all, you know, like you got all the best equipment. Unless you got a good song, you still got nothing.
Yeah.
So that will never change.
Let me ask you, because I gotta wrap up here. As far as your book that's out, first of all, where can fans get it? I know it's on Amazon. If there's any local bookstores left.
Well, there's a few. Actually, there's a lot more than I expected. I mean, I went through probably 6 or 7 cities, and most of them we went to. I think we did a couple of Barnes & Noble, but we did mostly more mom-and-pop kind of places. But what I found out was most of them do their business online. And so there's some competition for Amazon, you know, it keeps everybody kind of honest. There's nobody's got a monopoly, you know, so, basically the best thing to do is either order from your local bookstore, support the you know, mom and pop kind
right.
of places, or, you know, get it from Amazon. And right now, hopefully it should still be on the shelves. And, I know I signed a bunch of them, so there's still an opportunity to get some that have been signed, you know.
When people buy the book, is there a favorite story or one that comes to mind? If you got a quick one that you want to tell here at the end, is it stories about you on the road with these guys? Is it the whole thing, like Joe?
It's an autobiography from the time I put both feet on the ground. It's 64 years, man, of life. And
I've been a
part
fan
of that is Aerosmith. You know,
yeah, I've been a fan of you for so long that I know. Some of the story. I already remember, like, you told some cool story in some other interview where you, how you ended up getting into guitar. You were a young kid and there was these older guys sitting on the front porch playing guitar and you're like, it just sounded really cool. It just sort of captured your attention. Personally, I cannot wait to read it. And I am, like, fascinated with that whole period of music that you came up in. And I also like that whole thing where you guys, you know, had to stick your ear to a speaker or try and slow it down. And because I find a lot of times when I'm, you know, I mess around with guitar too, and I try to watch somebody play it, then turn my back to the video. Because then people, like the person will literally break it down, show you that where they put their fingers and stuff, and people will still ask for tabs. And I'm just looking at, like, don't you ever want to have the freedom to, like, basically, I've always figured becoming literate in music means you could listen to it and figure it out. Where if you always had to have tabs and everything, it was almost like you couldn't even read. You know what I mean?
Right.
Somebody had to hold your hand. And like, I think there's a lot of people out there that can really play all this shit, but if you just played it on a record, can you sit down? Maybe you don't need to do it anymore because there's someone who will break it down for you. But anyways, dude, I'm such a huge fan of you and your band and all the stuff that you guys have done. I never even thanked you for all the great music. I mean, it's basically a soundtrack of my youth.
Thanks.
I love all your stuff, and I'm so psyched for this book. I cannot wait to read it. Once again, it's called Joe Perry, My Life in and Out of Aerosmith. So psyched I finally got you here on the podcast. Good luck with the allergies. Thanks for sharing all your stories about guns and all this other stuff. I hope I asked you some different questions.
You did. It was great.
Okay.
And we'll have to do this again because I was, like I said, I was looking forward to it. I've been looking forward to it before the book. The main reason was because we're from Boston.
Yeah.
It's great to hear the accent.
I know. I can't get rid of it.
We'll do it again. We'll talk
definitely.
About Boston some more. You know,
definitely, definitely. All right. Joe Perry, his new book, My Life in and Out of Aerosmith, is available all over the internet. And if you got a mom and pop store down the street and you want to help them out, bookstore down there, please go down and pick it up. Joe Perry, thank you so much for listening to the Monday Morning Podcast. Hope to see you soon, okay?
It's an honor. Thank you.
All right, brother.